Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, dedicated to a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
In a way, it's almost like last week never happened. You can almost hear the sighs of relief on Wall Street since Monday's close. It's all about the fundamentals, the bulls will tell you. Nothing wrong with this economy. A little time can't fix. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals and institutions reach their long-term financial goals. 1-888-VANGUARD. And by American Public Media, announcing the important new book, Speaking of Faith, by public radio host Krista Tippett, in bookstores everywhere now.
From the Frank Stanton Studios right here in beautiful downtown Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Today's Thursday, March 8th. Glad you could be with us. Pay no attention to today's retail sales numbers. Sure, they were disappointing, but who really cares? On Wall Street, today was a day to celebrate the bounce. Investors gave a nod to favorable moves in the foreign exchange markets. Strong corporate profits, too. But it's been a rough week or so in stocks. And Ashley Milne-Tite reports from New York at least one part of the economy has come out ahead.
Today's rally in the U.S. followed a strong performance overnight by markets in Asia and Europe. Al Goldman is chief market strategist at A.G. Edwards. He says the gains represent a natural recovery from the bruising correction of last week.
The big thing that's behind today's gains and 2 days ago is that we remain in a bull market, supported by an economy that is slowing down but still growing, and corporate earnings, which are slowing down but still growing.
Still, the market is on tenterhooks, awaiting tomorrow morning's payroll numbers. Goldman says providing they come in as expected, that is, sluggish growth of around 100,000 jobs, the market will probably take a breather. Still, there's one sector of the economy that's benefited from the recent turmoil, the housing market. David Weiss is chief economist at Standard & Poor's.
People got scared of stock positions, so they tried to get their money out of stocks and shove it into the bond market. And that lowers bond yields. One of the things they buy, of course, are mortgage-backed bonds, so mortgage rates go down.
And that's good for housing, a sector that could use some help. What investors are wondering are whether the good news in the markets will continue in the days ahead. In New York, I'm Ashley Milne-Tite for Marketplace.
Congressional Democrats have moved on to Plan B in their attempt to stop the war in Iraq. The majority party has been unable to agree on exactly how it wants to get that done. Plan A was to cut off the funding, but that's proved politically difficult, so they unveiled their latest idea today, a series of deadlines to be attached to the president's emergency budget request. Marketplace's Hillary Wackay reports.
The Democrats will up the $100 billion in war funding, including more money for Afghanistan, veterans care, and health care for low-income children. But there's a catch. If the president can't show progress on benchmarks for the Iraqi government by July 1st, withdrawal of troops begins. If by October 1st the president can't certify the benchmarks have been completed, withdrawal begins then. Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi was clear who set the standards.
These are President Bush's benchmarks.
Even if the goals are reached, U.S. combat troops would have to begin withdrawing a year from now. Military analyst John Pike says the benchmarks start with improving security.
Diminution of violence against civilians, greater participation by Iraqi security forces in the defense of their own country, and they would have to be looking at getting this oil revenue distribution plan in place.
Some wonder if these are the right benchmarks. Michael O'Hanlon is with the Brookings Institution.
Do we know enough about counterinsurgency to write a formula that we can predict will be the correct one?
And how will these goals be measured?
It's always going to be subject to interpretation.
Gordon Adams is with the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. He says Democrats are following what they think the public wants.
Of course, they're attaching it to a supplemental appropriations bill, and the bet that they are making is the administration will sign off on its own benchmarks attached to an appropriations bill.
Don't bet too much. The White House has said it'll veto the bill. In Washington, I'm Hillary Wackay for Marketplace.
A couple of weeks ago, we told you about a big energy deal down in Texas. KKR is going to take TXU private in a $42 billion leveraged buyout, the biggest ever. But that's not what made it news. KKR had brought two leading environmental groups in on things. They managed to get some green concessions, including convincing the new owners to scrap plans for 8 new power plants. The buzz was environmentalists were getting serious about the nuts and bolts of big corporate deal-making. And there is word today one of those groups is beefing up its financial know-how. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Sam Eaton has the story.
The deal to slash most of TXU's planned coal-fired power plants from its roster is still in flux. Environmental Defense head Fred Krupp says over the next few weeks, the Texas energy giant will seek higher bids from rival suitors.
I mean, we just want to have expertise at our side so that no matter what happens, we're ready to engage in a pragmatic, constructive way as an informed advocate for the environment.
Environmental Defense has hired boutique investment bank Perilla Weinberg Partners. Krupp says his group may pursue similar deals with Wall Street in the future, potentially ushering in a new role for environmental groups in high-powered mergers and acquisitions. But Yale environmental law professor Daniel Esty says that shift is being driven by Wall Street, not the environmental community.
Environment has emerged as a core element of strategy, and so no company can be seen to ignore this issue.
Some studies suggest a powerful link between a company's environmental reputation and the performance of its stock price. But Bill Kovacs with the U.S. Chamber of Commerce says keeping investments safe from environmental backlash is one thing.
The bigger issue is Texas going to have enough energy and is it going to get it in time?
TXU's proposed coal plants would have added about 10% more electricity to the grid. Kovacs says making up that gap with other energy sources isn't going to happen without some economic hardship, possibly tainting the newly forged relationship between Wall Street and environmental groups. In Los Angeles, I'm Sam Eaton for Marketplace.
The internet phone carrier Vonage is about to get a bill for $58 million. A federal jury ruled today the company infringed three key patents belonging to Verizon. The verdict only adds to Vonage's trouble. Shares traded today at about $5 apiece. That's after going public in May at $17 apiece. Wikipedia is getting into the search engine business. That's the online group-edited encyclopedia. Its search will use the same collective process, but for profit, as Pat Loeb explains.
Wikipedia founder Jimmy Wales says a wiki search engine could take 5% of the internet search business. At a news conference in Tokyo, he took aim at the leading search engines, Google and Yahoo. He described them as black boxes because they don't reveal how they rank search results. He said the wiki formula that allows users to add and edit content collectively is superior. The search engine would be a product of Wikia Inc., Wales' for-profit enterprise. A Google spokesperson says the company welcomes the competition, as does Jim Lanzone, CEO of Ask.com. But Lanzone says he finds it ironic that Wikia is pursuing a search engine.
About 75% of Wikipedia's traffic comes from search engines like Google and Ask. So Wikipedia is somewhat biting the hand that feeds them with this new product.
Lanzone says the search business is tougher than it looks. Amazon and Microsoft both have struggled with the technology. Tara Kalashane, editor of Research Buzz, is more optimistic.
There have been attempts to make search engines or at least searchable subject indexes before using groups of people. And I think combined with the idea of Wikipedia putting a big data pool out there and letting anybody, you know, splash around and play in it, I think it's a great idea and I'm looking forward to seeing how it works.
Kalashane thinks a wiki search engine may also have problems, like spammers trying to get their sites to the top of results. I'm Pat Loeb for Marketplace.
Wall Street's hoping it's broken last week's string of bad luck. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. President Bush hasn't even landed in Brazil yet, but police there have already had to break out the tear gas to put down protests. About 6,000 people marched against the administration's proposal for an energy deal with the Brazilian government. Brazil's the leading producer of sugar-based ethanol. The president will be on the ground for just a day, enough time for about one big public event. It's a tour of a biofuel plant in Sao Paulo, biofuel as in ethanol. Also, he'll attend a meeting and a press conference with President Lula da Silva. Ruedern Rowett teaches Latin American policy at Johns Hopkins University. Professor Rowett, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
What's the main trade issue on the table here? Is it ethanol?
It is ethanol, but it's a whole series of issues. That the Brazilians, as spokesperson for the group of 20, which are more or less 20 countries that come together on trade, mostly developing countries, have really slowed down the World Trade Organization Doha round. They've also nixed the free trade area of the Americas. So I think the president is probably going to want to talk to President Lula in Sao Paulo about trade policy. Second, ethanol is an important long-range issue, but of course the United States places a tariff on Brazilian ethanol exports to the United States. So there isn't much room unless the president can convince Congress to drop that tariff, which is not going to happen anytime soon. And finally, not publicly, but privately, I would think President Bush will be speaking with President Lula about President Chavez of Venezuela.
The president, during his State of the Union speech, made a very big deal about increasing the use of renewable fuels in this country in the next decade or so. We don't have the production to do it, and yet we have maintained our tariffs on people who do have that production and could send us cheap ethanol.
Unfortunately, the United States government, in the hands of either political party, doesn't necessarily follow rational policies for the good of the country. This is one of those. The ethanol issue, of course, is very stark. The tariff protects corn producers, and the United States produces more inefficient ethanol from corn, but they happen to be in important states.
So there are very serious political ramifications here for the 2008 presidential election in this country.
Very serious. Already, one senior senator, Senator Grassley, has sent a very pointed letter to the White House saying, don't think of touching those tariffs.
Let me make sure I understand this. The Bush administration and the government in general want there to be more ethanol used, yet they won't allow the import of cheaper ethanol, which could get people buying ethanol more cheaply.
Exactly. It is double talk, and unfortunately, most people don't really understand the debate. There is some ethanol coming in because given prices of other products, at times the Brazilians are willing to pay the tariff. But clearly, if there are other opportunities for Brazil in, let's say, Asia or in other countries in Latin America, most of whom are energy poor, then clearly if I were the president of Brazil, I would thank President Bush for his interest, but tell my people to go find new markets without tariffs.
What I hear you saying, sir, is that this visit down to Brazil is mostly show and no substance.
It's very symbolic. This is the end of the administration. The president is a lame duck, as all presidents are in their last year and a half or 2 years. And overall, there's no grand strategy, no matter what the White House says, about what we can do, given our double deficits in the United States, to provide greater amounts of financial aid for the countries in the region.
Let me get very quickly back to something you mentioned at the beginning, the World Trade Organization, the round of Doha talks, which has stumbled on the issue of these subsidies, rich countries giving subsidies to their producers. Isn't there any chance that the United States will back off on subsidies just to get the Doha round going again?
One would like to think so, but of course it is not just the United States, it is also the European Union, and they, in a sense, are dug in even deeper in protecting subsidies for their farmers. And there's also something on the other side of the table, that intellectual property rights, which the U.S. and the European Union want protected and augmented in the developing countries. The developing countries say, hey, we're not ready to do that yet, we're developing. So there's blame on both sides, and no one seems to be able to find a middle ground.
Reardon Ruette is the director of the Western Hemisphere Studies Program at Johns Hopkins University in Washington, D.C. Professor Ruette, thanks very much for your time.
You're very welcome.
Brazil uses sugar to make its ethanol. We make ours from corn. And as we just heard, that crop gets substantial protection in Washington. American sugar producers have their own political backers as well. But groups at the other end of the production chain want to change that and end those federal subsidies. Stuart Cohen explains one part of the fight over this year's farm bill.
At the Getz Candy Company's factory in Baltimore, the air is so thick with sugar, you can taste it in every breath.
Well, this is where we twist wrap all the caramel cream product. This takes the caramel with the white center and twist wraps it with the two fins, which some people call the kiss, which is basically the icon of our company.
Owner Mitchell Getz says any change in the price of sugar affects his ability to make the company's signature caramel creams and keep the family business going. Even a small drop in price would help.
You could even go down to a tenth of a cent, a half a cent. I mean, really, at this point, you know, with a U.S. manufacturer, the insurance costs are not going to go down. Our workman's comp is not going to go down. Our energy costs are through the roof. Every single savings in cost, even with pennies, is significant.
But here's the sticky part. Unlike other ingredients, the price Getz pays for sugar isn't set by the law of supply and demand. It's set by the laws of Congress. A decades-long government policy sets minimum sugar prices and limits imports of cheaper sugar. That keeps prices high compared to the world market. Larry Graham is president of the National Confectioners Association. He says that program also helps sugarcane and beet farmers at the expense of sugar users, like candy makers. So for this year's farm bill, he's pushing a different deal for farmers.
Open up the program so that it's a free market program, so that my companies and other companies who use sugar can buy sugar on a free market. And in the meantime, certain subsidy payments would be made to the farmers as they transition into other crops.
In other words, farmers give up fixed sugar prices in return for government cash. Supporters of that approach say similar programs in the past have worked for peanut and tobacco farmers. But the sugar industry likes the sweet deal they've got going now. They argue subsidies would shift the cost to the federal budget, and there's no telling how long it would be before Congress sours on the idea of keeping sugar farmers on the government dole. Besides, as Jack Roney of the American Sugar Alliance says, the free market isn't really free at all.
120 countries around the world produce sugar. They all have government programs of some sort, and many of them overproduce and dump the surplus on the world market for whatever price it would bring. And that price has averaged less than half the world average cost of producing sugar for the last 20 years.
And he says that could put family farms in 17 states that produce sugar out of business. So the industry is fighting hard to keep the current program, contributing nearly $3 million to candidates in last year's congressional election. But Dan Griswold, director of trade policy studies at Washington's Cato Institute, says there's no easy solution to the sugar industry's reliance on government support.
The sugar program almost killed the Central American Free Trade Agreement. It can't be the focus of U.S. policy to protect everybody's job from any kind of competition. Far more Americans lose their job every day because of internal competition, new technologies, so we can't be out there trying to save every job, every farm.
For Mitchell Goetz and the bulk of small family businesses that dominate both the candy industry and sugar farming, it's now left to the big players to fight it out on Capitol Hill over the future of sugar prices.
I look at my two small daughters and I think of what's going on with costs, whether it be manufacturing costs or ingredient costs, and I really do wonder, will we be here in 100 years? But I'm fifth generation, and I feel as if it's my duty to be a good steward and hand it on to the sixth generation.
In Washington, I'm Stuart Cohen for Marketplace.
Coming up, there are some things in France that you just don't do.
This morning, I was ashamed to be French, the first time in my life.
We'll tell you what's got him so riled up, but first, let's do the numbers. Investors spent the day buying up some bargains created by last week's pullback. The Dow Industrials climbed 68 points today, about a half a percent, to close at 12,260. The NASDAQ gained 13 points, half a percent, ending at 2387. The S&P 500 rose 9 points, about 7-tenths of 1% there, wrapped up the day at 1401. Hopes that investment banks will benefit from the recovery on global markets helped boost shares in Goldman Sachs by more than 2% today. Likewise, Bear Stearns, its stock picked up 1.8%. Meanwhile, investors were making a connection with AT&T. That stock enjoyed its biggest gain in more than a month and a half, thanks to an analyst's report that AT&T's wireless business is growing. Its shares closed up by more than 3%. Overseas markets rallied today. Tokyo's Nikkei Index closed up by almost 2%. London's FTSE, Germany's DAX, and the CAC 40 in Paris all gained around 1%. Bond prices slipped. That sent the yield on the 10-year T-note up to 4.51%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by A.G. Edwards, caring for nest eggs for more than 120 years, with a commitment to provide objective financial advice. Want to know what's in the works at Marketplace? How about getting the latest news and features in an email? Sign up for the Marketplace Midday Update. It will keep you up to date on the day's business news and let you know what to expect on our next program. Go to marketplace.org and click on the newsletter link on the right.
Here's a look at the Marketplace Datebook for events coming up Friday. In Washington, the Labor Department reports on unemployment for February. The House Energy and Commerce Committee convenes a hearing on a bill to prohibit fraudulent access to telephone records. And if you've been waiting for a time to flip out, tomorrow is your day. It's Panic Day. Organizers suggest running around telling people you just can't handle it anymore, but don't take yourself too seriously. And of course, don't sweat the small stuff. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. McDonald's said today sales were up almost 6% last month. Burgers and fries were especially big sellers in Asia, China in particular. Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson's over there today. I have no idea what he's eating, but he's urging the Chinese to open their markets to more foreign competition. Everybody wants to do business in the world's biggest market, Americans included. Commentator James Mann suggests we're not thinking about it the right way.
Don't worry. Be happy. That's what we're told when anyone asks about China's repression of all organized opposition. Our trade with China will change its political system. It's a tack Bill Clinton took when he said the opening up of China's political system was inevitable. George W. Bush continued it, telling us we should trade freely with China since time is on our side. Well, perhaps it's not. America's trade deficit with China was $15 billion a year when President Clinton took office, $70 billion a year when George W. Bush came to the White House, and more than $230 billion last year. Meanwhile, there's no sign of Chinese political liberalization. In recent years, China's authoritarian leaders have provided important support to other repressive regimes around the world, to Zimbabwe, to Burma, to the leaders of North Korea and Sudan. This idea that our trade with China is going to change its political system is one part rationalization and one part vanity. It's a rationalization for American companies that want to do business with China and don't want to be bothered with questions about political repression. It's a kind of vanity for the American people, who tend to believe that everybody else wants to become like us. But democracy doesn't necessarily follow just because McDonald's and Starbucks arrive. Instead, we should look at trade in strictly economic terms, examining its costs and benefits without phony arguments that it will transform China's political system. And we should look at the broader picture with China, too. How will China deal with the world a few decades from now, when it's far more powerful than it is today? What if, contrary to what our presidents have told us, time and history are not on our side?
James Mann's latest book is called The China Fantasy. You know where to find us. It's marketplace.org. Just click on that link that says contact. It's often said that a given work of art is priceless, but everything can be bought, as we learned earlier this week about one very famous French museum. The Louvre has licensed out its name and some of its contents to the United Arab Emirates. Many French museum curators and art historians are calling the deal a sellout. John Lawrenson reports from Paris it might be about selling something. It's just not clear what.
Switch off, okay? I don't want to see that anymore.
A security guard plunges into the crowd in front of the most famous painting in the world to enforce the no-photo rule. The Mona Lisa is not, of course, one of the artworks the Louvre's about to bag up and send to the Middle East, but 300 other artworks will go on display in the Louvre Abu Dhabi when it opens in 2012, and a wing of the Paris Louvre will be named Sheikh Zayed after the founder of the United Arab Emirates. In return, Abu Dhabi will give France $1.3 billion.
This morning I was ashamed to be French, the first time in my life.
The art historian Didier Rickner has launched a web petition called The Louvre is Not for Sale. It's now got 4,500 signatures.
The purpose of a museum is not to serve the economic interest. You can argue with this, you know, you can say a museum must serve the economic interest, a museum is there for this. It's an opinion which can be respectful. But you must say this, you know, and you must discuss about it. They don't say this. They say it's a cultural, it's a, the enlightenment of the French everywhere. They say it's for the well-being of the world. It's all false, you know. It's only a diplomatic and financial project.
Monsieur Rickner was already upset enough about the Louvre lending masterpieces to America's High Museum in what his website described with a shudder as the Coca-Cola-rich city of Atlanta. But that was only a three-year deal. Louvre Abu Dhabi is for 30. Rickner says Louvre Abu Dhabi is really about selling airplanes. The UAE is one of Airbus's best customers and has promised to buy 50 of the French-based consortium's new super jumbos. It's a charge France's culture minister, Renaud Donadieu de Vabre, rejects outright.
I'm very shocked, you know, by the question, because it's a cultural matter. It's a goal of cultural diversity. In a period of violence or terrorism, it's a good point to try, you know, to build good links between every country. Arabic countries, European countries, Western countries.
As for the Louvre's president, Henri Lauriet, he's come round to the idea because of what the setting up of a museum like the Louvre would represent in the Middle East.
Just the idea of wanting a museum which is broader, you know, and which is on the model of the Louvre, interested dealing with all kinds of works, of kinds of civilization, it's just something which is quite new.
But will they be? Questions are being asked about the sort of works that will be lent to Abu Dhabi, about nudes in a country that's strict about modesty, and paintings of Christ in a part of the world where promoting Christianity is punishable by law. The Louvre could bring more openness to the Middle East, or the Middle East could bring less of it to the Louvre. In Paris, I'm John Lawrenson for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments. Since 1937, supporting the role that an experienced financial advisor can play in building a well-rounded financial program. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
This final note before we go, here's an economic statistic you don't run across every day, toilet shortages. And here's a country you don't hear about very often, Luxembourg. You almost never hear them in the same sentence, but here you go. Luxembourg tops the list of countries on the latrine shortage list. A report out from the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development details global living conditions. Luxembourg is one of the world's richest countries, and officials there have been scratching their heads about that report. They are said to be rechecking their data for errors. We don't make it up, folks. We just report it. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow rose 68 points, about a half a percent. The NASDAQ picked up 13 points, also half a percent. The S&P 500 gained 9 points today. That is 7 tenths on that particular index. Our editors include John Buckley, Margaret Koval, Karen Lowe, Stacey Vanek-Smith, and Lisa Tucker. Next time, are your company IT guys shaking in their shoes? Because the ones here are.
Companies are having to make changes. I mean, it's going to affect travel. It's going to affect intercontinental conference calls. It's the biggest thing in my eyes since Y2K scare.
Who knew daylight savings time could be so scary? I'm Kai Rizdahl. I hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.